Hey folks, Heather Cox Richardson and Joanne Freeman here. Thank you for being members of the Cafe Insider community.
This is Backstage, a special segment of the Now and Then podcast exclusively for you. We hope you enjoy it. So Heather, we just spent a long time thinking about questions of education and what's included in education and different voices and what they think. Maybe now is a moment for us really to think a little bit about ourselves at this moment as teachers and what we're thinking about our role and what we're teaching.
All right. So let's just start here with the fact that when people are complaining about critical race theory and talking about what teachers should and shouldn't do in the classroom and all that, first of all, what drives me bananas about this is that have you ever been in a K through 12 history classroom?
That's the thing, right? So there's a lot of people saying a lot of things about classrooms, and they clearly, never mind K through 12, high school, college, any classroom. These are people talking of an imaginary classroom somewhere in the clouds.
Yeah, really. If you can get your students to read the syllabus, you're doing a great job.
Right.
So how many of your classes do you have a class on critical race theory?
You know, but see, here's
none,
the thing.
Does none,
none
come to mind?
None comes to mind. But here's the thing about that question, and it's why this topic is so important, right? I can say, yeah, none. I'm not teaching critical race theory. But then someone could say, well, but you're teaching racism is some way or another built into the system and has been for a long time. So you're teaching critical race theory. I'm not. But the fuzziness of what people are talking about here is part of why this is so tricky to talk about in a classroom situation.
And as we said, there's absolutely no way you can teach American history without talking about race and gender and so on.
Precisely.
But so it is, in a funny way, a continuation of all the many complaints that we hear in the media about the way we teach. And one of my favorites over the past many years has been Howard Zinn. You know, you see all these articles about how, you know, leftist historians do nothing but teach Howard Zinn. And I don't know if you saw this, but there was this thing that went around on social media about sort of taking a poll. Does anybody know of anybody who teaches Howard Zinn?
Someone in a movie.
Exactly.
It was Goodwill Hunting, right? Doesn't that have Howard Zinn in it somewhere?
So the funny thing about that is that I actually do teach Howard Zinn, or I have taught Howard Zinn, because my students demanded it. I teach a class in classics in American history. And by that, it's a really interesting class, actually, because I literally sat down and wrote a list of all the books that people say, oh, that's a classic, you know? But then you never really study them all together. And I didn't really know what that meant. I had no rhyme or reason to what I was going to do. It ended up being a really great class. And we did, you know, George Bancroft and Frederick Jackson Turner and Angie DeBow and Walter Prescott Webb and Richard Hofstadter and in the whole way up, W.B. Du Bois. But I stopped in 1970 and my students were like, well, why isn't Howard Zinn on this list? And I'm like, because it's not a real history book. And they're like, how can you not call it a classic? It sold 2 million copies. So I'm like, okay, we'll read it. So I put it on the syllabus. And in the beginning of that, in the introduction of that, Zinn actually says, this is not a standalone book. This is a book that is there to balance out all the other histories you read. And the fun of it was that in this course, I had one self-identified conservative student, one of my favorite students, took a lot of classes with me. And he and I both had been reluctant to read the book while we'd been pushed by the rest of the class, which was self-identified on the left. One person was really quite far on the left. And we read this book. And the conservative student and I both loved the book. The one who said it wasn't history and the one who said he was a conservative loved the book. And all the people who've been on the left are like, this is crap. He doesn't have evidence. And this other the student and I were both like, but he says what he's going to do. He makes an argument and he does it. This is great. This is an intervention in the way people think about history. He's making a project. He's making it happen. And all the people who were supposed to be out there being indoctrinated were like, we hate this thing. And many years later, he actually wrote and when we were corresponding and I said, hey, do you remember that class? And he goes, the one about Howard Zinn? That was great. I've never forgotten that.
Well, here's the thing. Here's the wonderful thing about that story. And it goes right back to your comment earlier about a lot of people say having a lot to say about education and indoctrination and clearly have not been near a classroom. What happened in that classroom was, in a sense, a debate or a conversation, and some people agreed with an idea and some people didn't, and you actually read the book and saw statements like, hey, this isn't meant to be a standalone history. So something that people are whacking at out in the world, pundits, et cetera, they're angry at something that actually doesn't exist, since the book doesn't argue to be that kind of text. But the important point here is what happens in a classroom is, in a sense, a conversation. And sometimes it's a debate of a conversation. Sometimes it's more of a kind of sharing conversation. But that's what good teaching is to allow people in a room to talk about ideas, to bounce ideas off of each other, to learn from each other, and to really think about connections. So a lot of what people are talking about nowadays is what to not allow people to talk about in classrooms. That's stripping away part of teaching. And a stellar example for me, just in the last year, in my Zoom teaching year, I taught my first semester as a Zoom teacher a course called The Creation of the American Politician. And all of my courses that I teach at Yale are early American courses. So I get up to Andrew Jackson and then I start to fade very quickly. So this course is pretty much 1790 to 1820. And we met a few times and we talked about American politics in a variety of different ways. And one student wrote to me privately and said, Professor Freeman, I don't think I could take this class and talk about American politicians and not think about the present. There's so much happening right now. I don't know how to stay out of the present. And normally, I'm pretty adamant about that. I want us to stay in the past. I didn't think that was a responsible thing to do right now. But I also was not, as I suppose some people, pundits out in the world say, trying to indoctrinate my students about public events. What I did in this class, and it actually worked amazingly well, we would have the hour and 20 minutes or hour and 10 minutes in which we would talk about a book. And in the last 10 or 20 minutes, I would open things up. And the question would basically be, what did today's reading make you think about, or how is it changing the way you understand what's going on today? And that's pretty much all I said. And they talked to each other and they bounced ideas around and they wondered about things and they made connections. There was no one enforcing any view on anyone, but it was so meaningful to them and I could see it, to just have a climate, a place where they could just talk about these things, that there was really no space to talk about it. And to me, that was a great classroom situation. You know, the classroom that I created over the course of the semester was a welcoming place where people were free to say whatever they wanted. And in that space, it was a perfect place for people to really kind of struggle with what was going on and see how understanding history enabled them to understand the present differently. I mean, that's teaching.
Yeah, I was going to say, which is, after all, what teachers are supposed to do.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea that we sort of back up a dump truck into our students' brains and fill them full of things is not at all what our enterprise is about.
No.
It's about enabling people to ask questions and to evaluate information and to know what they can trust and what they can't.
It's about giving them thinking tools, right? Content also is part of their thinking tools, how to think about the present by understanding the past, how to read intelligently, how to write intelligently. You know, we're equipping them to go out into the world and evaluate the present and evaluate evidence. And they have to be given the space to do that. And they have to be given the chance to evaluate ideas and accept and reject some.
Well, so now I'm going to get in trouble with you because Uh-oh. This to me is the whole point of what we do, both in the classroom and when we write history, because it's part of the enterprise of the Enlightenment. The idea that you, I know I look at your face.
It's my Enlightenment expression.
But the idea that you don't simply indoctrinate people, that you give them the tools to evaluate reality on their own, and then you trust them to make good decisions about it, as opposed to simply saying, we can't let you know these ideas because these ideas are dangerous. That sounds to me very much like a country that's based in religion or in tradition or in, you know, some sort of dominant society saying to the peons, you can't think for yourself, you have to do what you're told.
No, and that really isn't part of an Enlightenment take. Right, is that you are given the tools to think and process and you're supposed to run wherever they go. Thomas Jefferson says this a number of times to a number of young relatives. And
you had to work him
in,
didn't you?
I totally did. And I'm watching your face.
You're making that up. He didn't say that.
No, he really did. He really did.
No, he didn't.
Follow your curiosity wherever it leads you. The other side of the Enlightenment, and the reason why I was smiling, is there is this sort of fundamental belief that if you do that, and if you follow your curiosity where it takes you, then you can see the eternal laws and rules of the universe and frame the present so that they're following the laws and rules of the universe, as though there are these sort of eternal laws of order, which is not part of the Enlightenment enterprise that we necessarily buy into. But you're totally right that the spirit of, literally, Enlightenment, the spirit of following thought where it takes you, following study where it leads you, and questioning what you find, yes, I will have a pleasant, good-humored smile on my face and say that is correct, rather than a slightly bemused expression on my face.
Well, I guess where I was going with that is the idea that people who claim to be protecting the Western canon say, shut up and do what you're told.
Well, it would be nice if they read parts of the Western canon. I mean, this gets back to you saying that the beginning of Howard Zinn says this is not meant to stand alone. Sometimes, as a historian, as a scholar, I'm sure this is true for lots of other scholars of lots of other disciplines, part of the infuriating aspect of what happens in the public sphere is people with a lot to say in a very angry voice who very clearly have never read any of the things they're yelling about, just like they've never been in a classroom. And you can stand back a little bit from that, but you can't totally stand back from that because some of what they're saying has an impact. And as a teacher and as a scholar and as a historian, I mean, this is why we're doing what we're doing here, right? Is that we feel the need to step forward sometimes, and Newby does too, apparently. He's chirping in the background. We feel the need to step forward at some point, sometimes, and say, no, actually, here are some facts, here's some evidence, and here's a way to actually think about this and evaluate this rather than rant about this with no evidence.
But you know what worries me in this moment especially is that that very impulse to read the documents has become politicized.
That's totally true.
So the number of times that I have advanced an argument that is 1,000% grounded in the documents, only to have somebody coming back at me and saying, you should read the documents.
Right.
Even to the extent of critical race theory. I can't tell you how many people have said to me, you need to read critical race theory. It's like, what do you think I'm doing over here?
No, it's totally true. That's totally true. And it doesn't matter. As a matter of fact, we're almost less trustworthy because we're professors, right? Is that we have some agenda and we're tricky and we're trying to say something and twist the evidence. But you're right. And then it becomes even more frustrating. You step forward and you say, well, no, actually, you know, we've read 52 of these documents and every single one from this moment, and they all say whatever. And if a person doesn't want that to be true, they will find a way for that not to be true. And okay, you're going to laugh at me now. It reminds me very much of the early—
Don't you dare say Thomas Jefferson.
No, he's in there, okay. But I wasn't going to say his name. No, it reminds me of the early 19th century when all of these sort of founding era folk were beginning to write histories and biographies and autobiographies. And basically, people were trying to create a history of what happened in the founding era. And what's fascinating about it is they all say in one way or another, I've got documents. I've got primary documents. Yeah, John Marshall writes about Washington, says, I've got Washington's letters, right? I have to say the name Jefferson. Also, he's like, I've got letters. I've got memoranda. I have the real stuff. And none of their histories agree with each other, right? So they have the evidence. And the evidence they have is part of where they were coming from and agrees with what they thought at the time. So it does raise a bigger question. Well, it gets us back to debate, right? If you, in a spirit of fairness and a spirit of being willing to evaluate evidence and accept different views, can debate issues, ideally history, then that's meaningful. If you can't do that, if basically you're looking for ways to find that desperately that you want to be right, which is kind of where we are right now, you're not going to have a conversation. Thank you for joining us backstage.
Be sure to write to us with your thoughts and questions at letters@cafe.com. See you next time.